Good morning. John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joy is off on her quest to see the eclipse today. And yes, it is good to be back. Thanks for asking. Following the deadly violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, between white supremacists and counter-protesters last weekend, tensions remained high as other far-right rallies were planned around the country for this past weekend. The right to free assembly is enshrined in our Constitution, but are there limits? What about language? Are there words that are not protected by the First Amendment? This hour we'll talk about the difference between free speech and hate speech, and what language is protected under the First Amendment. We will also discuss how states across the nation are reacting to this issue. So what do you think? What's your reaction to the rallies that took place this past weekend? Where do you think the line is between free speech and hate speech? Do you think the First Amendment should be somehow reformulated? Are there limits to free speech protection? And if so, where do you think the line is between what should be protected and what should not? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program. You can write to ideas@wpr.org. You can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. My guest this hour is Donald Downs, Alexander Michael John Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Law, and Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning, Professor Downs. Thank you for being on the program today.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Well, pretty good so far, but the day's just getting started, so...
Understood.
I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. We had a week ago violent clashes between the so-called alt-right groups and counter-protesters in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thousands of people poured into the streets of Boston and other cities over the weekend to denounce racism and white supremacy. And while there were some angry words and confrontations, things were relatively peaceful in Boston. The rally organized by the conservative Boston Free Speech Coalition drew just a small crowd and ended early, but was overwhelmed by the huge crowd of counter-protesters. What's your assessment of what happened in Boston on Saturday?
Well, I think that the best thing that happened was that the police did not stand down like they did in Virginia. They stood up to protect the rights of the speakers, and apparently the group that spoke in Boston was not, they made a pretty clear statement that they were there for free speech. They're concerned about what's happening in higher education, et cetera. They didn't have the same number of hard right, like Nazi individuals that they had at Charlottesville. At least that's my impression. So the group was less controversial. And if I'm right, and the counter demonstrators behaved themselves, and there were a lot of police there, and I think it in Virginia you had probably more extremes on certainly more extremes on the right side, probably some of these anti-fascist groups on the other side, and the strange thing was that the police really didn't do anything; they just sort of quote unquote stood down, and so the two groups got near each other. And, you know, the rest was with the violence, which was highly unfortunate.
I'm going to set part of that question aside because I want to get to something that happened in Boston that was different than what happened in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
The permit for Saturday's event on the Boston Common had some strings attached. There was a ban on, for example, backpacks, sticks,
talk,
and
right.
anything that could be used as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
In Virginia, that was not the case, and the Governor McAuliffe said that the protesters were better armed than the police in that case.
That's a good point. I should have mentioned that, but I didn't know that. And when looking over the news story, I did not notice that. But that's a really good point. and I see the ACLU now is saying that it will not provide the kind of support it did for the group in Boston if they're armed, which I think is certainly a good idea from a practical standpoint. It's also probably legal from a constitutional standpoint, right? You have a right to send out your message, but in a dangerous situation, they can disarm you. And, of course, that should also apply to the counter-demonstrators. I think one reason that the far right has been arming up more is because they're getting threats from some people on the far left. And so you're getting this kind of arms race, which is, you can't really conduct free speech under those circumstances. Max Weber once wrote, the great sociologist, that a legitimate state has a monopoly on the use of violence. I mean, it's a little bit overstated. You have a right of self-defense, right? But the state has to be have presence there, and it's okay for the state to be armed to promote order. But if either one of the two sides are going to be armed and create disorder, then that's not a good thing, and that's the end of free speech. So your point's really well taken, John.
Well, I think one thing that a lot of people who probably haven't taken a constitutional law class don't know is that Boston was perfectly within its rights to limit the kinds of things that could take place during the protest,
right.
Not the
right.
speech, but the way it was conducted. And
absolutely.
I mean, that's a fine point of law. That's not why we're here. But there are restrictions that local governments can place on various types of public activities.
And that also includes permits.
Right.
Some people say, oh my gosh, it's a free country, I don't need a permit. But if you have a large group of people, it's okay to have a permit system as long as it's efficient and that it's not overly expensive and if it's not used as a pretext to keep somebody from speaking. So there's a whole set of constitutional rules here. I have found that one of the biggest problems in public thinking about what's been going on in these demonstrations is a lack of just fundamental knowledge on what First Amendment doctrine and jurisprudence consists of. And for 30 years, I taught a big course here on First Amendment, and my main reason was to just inform students about these things so they can make more intelligent decisions when it came to these issues.
I think you've hit on a great point. Most of us really, you know, we might actually have read the text of the First Amendment,
right.
But there's a lot more to it than that. And obviously, there's over 200 years of interpretations by various courts
right.
that have gone into shaping how that
right.
how that actually works as a matter of law.
Yeah. I think I got to say three things here. I mean, one has to do with there's been change in the content of what's protected. It's more protected today than it ever has been. We have the most protected free speech doctrine in the world, which is worth talking about. The other is that there are certain restrictions based on time, place, and manner. So it's how the speech is done. You don't have a right to make a loud speech right next to a hospital if there are people in there sleeping. It can be restricted, you know, the sound level. They can maybe move you a half block away. Those are classic time, place, and manner restrictions, which do not interfere with what you're saying. They just temper how you say it, because there are other social interests that have to be respected. And then the third point goes back to our other point. It's a system of free speech. Listeners have rights. Speakers have rights. Counter-protesters have rights. And there are reciprocal duties that each of those components have toward everyone that's involved. And the key factor here is the police. You can't have a free society where people are expressing controversial views that make people mad without having a strong enough police force to maintain order. So that's something that we tend not to think about enough. And there are certain forces in our society now that are taking the rights into their own hands and say, we don't need the police. So, you know, the anti-fascist people say, we don't need the police. We want to take care of these guys. And then, of course, the fascists are saying, you know, these people are unentitled to counter protest, and they're saying horrible things. I've watched some of what content of some of the neo-Nazis' discourse. It's, you know, quite provocative, to say the least. But police have to be there to maintain this delicate balance of rights.
You mentioned the horrible things that were being said, and I don't want to, let's talk about that right now for just a moment. We're starting to get close to news time, but
sure.
There is something called the fighting words doctrine.
Right.
Do you think, in your view, looking at the text of some of the things that were said in Charlottesville, for example,
right.
Does any of that cross the threshold of into fighting words, which are not a protected
right.
speech?
Well, in content, it does, but the to use a racial epithet directed at a person, or I can think of the church, the Westboro Church, that say horrible things about the soldiers have died to their parents. Those are fighting words in content, but fighting words also requires a certain context, that it be directed right at somebody. So if you're getting up there and you're just making a general speech saying racist things, of course that's a bad thing, but you have a constitutional right to say it for a lot of reasons we can talk about. But if you say it face-to-face with somebody, that's when the real danger becomes. So it has to be targeted at a particular person. And I assume you might have had cases like that on an individual basis in Boston. I didn't see that, but what I saw was the more general rhetoric. So if you can't make a general rhetoric fighting words, but when a really, you know, hard-hitting, vicious kind of statement is directed at someone, that could either be a fighting word or it could even be just an illegal threat, mm-hmm. Which has never been protected by free speech. The point is you got to define it right, and you've got to, you know, make sure you're applying it to the right kind of situation.
We're talking about free speech issues surrounding various types of protest this hour, how these protests take place, what can be said, what can't be said. Where do you think the line is? There were a lot of people who were incredibly offended by the things that were shouted in the streets in Charlottesville and elsewhere. What do you think what do you think we should do about it? Is there a line that can't be crossed? 800-642-1234. Donald Downs is my guest. We'll be back and have more of a discussion with him and take your calls after some news coming up next. We're talking about free speech and a time of protest. And a lot of upheaval. Social media is certainly a part of this. There's a lot of arguing and threats being made. People saying absolutely horrible things to one another. How much of this is protected speech? How much of it crosses the line into unprotected speech? We're discussing those questions and others. Hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. My guest is Donald Downs, Alexander Michael John Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So, Professor, you know, I mean, obviously there's a fine line to be walked here because the idea of free speech is sort of a sacred one in America. We have, as you pointed out, we have the most free speech of any country in the world. Is there a point where can we stop speech from happening if we feel it is dangerous? And then I guess the follow-up to that would be who gets to decide what's dangerous and what is not. But what should police do when they think things are getting out of hand?
Right. Well, really kind of two aspects here. I mean, one is a more general issue with Heckler's veto, which I'll do second. But assuming that a speaker has a right to be there, if it's a bigger situation, has a permit, or otherwise has a right to be there, and says things that are provocative, that, you know, it might have a case where just right away by saying something, it's illegal. If you make a threat, like a bomb threat or something, you could be arrested on the spot. You've already broken the law. That's pretty clear. But what if you're just saying something that's within your rights but is highly provocative? And the Supreme Court has long, you know, for 50-plus years, really coming out of the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement, that's where they developed these doctrines, so you said something really provocative, but you have a right to say it, but then someone in the audience gets mad about it. And that's what's called a heckler's veto. I say, get that speaker out of here or I'm going to cause trouble. Well, the first obligation of the police, and this has been pretty settled, it started out in a dissent in Supreme Court law back in 1951, Justice Black, and then it became the majority of the court. It became majority doctrine, which happens a lot. First Amendment's full of a lot of really important cases which started out as dissents and then became accepted doctrine. And now, just in 2015, a U.S. Court of Appeal clearly articulated this doctrine, which had been developed in a dissent in the Supreme Court. The obligation of the police is first and foremost, if the speech is going on, to protect the right of the speaker, because the speaker has a right to be there, and if a heckler can keep the speaker from speaking, you're basically putting constitutional rights in the hands of people who want to shut people down, into the hands of hecklers. So the first obligation is to try to deal with the hecklers, protect the right of the speakers. And if at some point they get so many hecklers, you have a dangerous situation and a disruption of the peace is about to take place and police protecting the speaker isn't going to help that situation anymore, at that point they can ask the speaker to step down. And if the speaker doesn't step down and it is a reasonable police order, then the speaker can be arrested. Now, if the police make an improper order to step down and the speaker doesn't, and is arrested, then that arrest would be thrown out because the speaker does not have the right to obey an unconstitutional speech order from the police in the context of free speech. So you have to kind of look at all those different factors. Now, the other question is, you know, someone makes a request to hold a rally, and the institution, the town, or more likely these days the college or university, says, we can't really do that. It's going to be too dangerous. We don't have the right kind of resources to handle you. You're too provocative. That's a constitutional no-no, at least for a while, at least after a while. You might want to call, I want to speak tomorrow, and you're going to be a really provocative speaker, like this guy from Greece. I always forget his name, Yiannopoulos. And this college says, we can't have you speak tomorrow. We're not ready to have you because we know what happened at Berkeley when you showed up and had all that riot, literally a riot, you know, and fires and everything. Arms were brought to that. It was a horrible situation in Berkeley a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
We can't handle that. That would probably be okay. That would be a case where a prior restraint would be okay because the college really isn't prepared. But the college does have a constitutional duty, if this person is a protected speaker, to let that person come, which means that they're going to have to start getting their act in order and get police organized and things like that, because you can't just postpone that speaker from coming forever. That's a prior restraint, and that's violating that speaker's rights and the rights of people who might want to listen to that person. So sometimes a temporary stay, if it's clear that disorder will happen and the state's not ready for it, but then the state has to get ready for it as soon as it can.
Mm-hmm.
It's really common sense when you think about it, when you think it through.
Yeah, when you think it through, I think the problem comes in when things are done in the heat of the moment.
Right.
Sometimes, you know, we don't have the time to actually process all of that.
Right.
And people react.
Right.
And that often results in unfortunate outcomes.
Absolutely. And you know, I was thinking about Mark Twain in this talk, because in so many ways we're sort of back in the 60s, but it's also different. And, you know, when Twain said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, I kind of feel like it's rhyming right now.
Yeah.
And
we had the
Skokie case where the Nazis had to wait a year to go in there because to get things in order was such a big deal. It took a year for the courts to finally get through it and to have their counter demonstration, which never took place anyway. So sometimes you can't postpone these things.
Well, I mean, what's different now? I mean, racial hatred, neo-Nazi hate groups have been active. They've been around for a long time in the United States. The tragic events in Charlottesville may have brought them into the national spotlight. But what's new, what's different now, for example, than when the Nazis wanted to march in Skokie?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it gets to kind of deeper political issues right now. Well, first of all, the Nazi group in Skokie was, when all is said and done, a punk little group that was despised by almost everybody, even in their own neighborhood. They were not the major threat that the Holocaust survivors thought they were. The Holocaust survivors, I wrote a book about Skokie, so this is how I got my job at Madison. And the Holocaust survivors, the one who made that an issue, because for them it was a nightmare reborn. It was not. Though understandable why they felt that way. They were really not that much of a threat. The bigger threat was in the South with the Ku Klux Klan and groups like that. And at that time, the Ku Klux Klan was highly infiltrated by the federal government. If you're a subversive organization that has a dangerous ideology, the federal government can keep a big eye on you. And since anyone can join your group if you let them, an undercover federal agent can join too. So they had really kept tabs on these guys. Today, we have a much more organized right. Just reading some of this material that I've looked at and watching some of the takes on Charlottesville and interviews, it's a more concerted movement. You know, I'm not saying they're all Nazis. I mean, it's like any movement, you're going to have moderates. You're going to have people that aren't even part of it, but that listen to them. You're going to have the hardcore. My guess is it's more of a hardcore now. I'm not an expert on these guys, but that's my guess. Maybe a caller can give us better information. And also because there's a greater hysteria in our body politic over this stuff because of the election, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Trump is considered, I don't know to what extent Trump sympathizes with groups like this or not. He's married to, his daughter's married to a Jewish man. I don't think he's anti-Semitic or anything, but whatever. A lot of people think that Trump's policies and Trump's personality was such a shock to people, and he has been touted by members of, you know, the hard right and the alt-right, the abandoned in the White House. So there's a kind of fear and anger about what happened in the election, and even some hysteria about it. I mean, people were crying in the streets the next day. That never happened in an election in my lifetime. I know people that came out of that election totally different in terms of how they reacted to the person they wanted to win losing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more fear out there. And to some extent, there's some reason to be fear, given these groups now that are coalescing and organizing. Now, the other side is they're reacting, a lot of them, to what's going on in higher education, where speakers are getting shouted down. I've heard them explicitly say that. I've been predicting this kind of thing for 2 years now.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't let it's not just, you know, hard right Nazis that are being kept out of colleges. Yet Charles Murray was attacked, and the woman that brought him in, a liberal political scientist, got beat up and given a concussion. And there were some anti-fascist groups involved in that. So tensions have really gotten high, and we don't seem to have the kind of constructive national leadership to kind of help us come together as a community and deal with this stuff more constructively. Just my feeling. You know, that's not an expert comment.
Sure. We have callers who want to discuss this issue. Let's go to the phones. We'll start in Loganville, where Richard is with us. Good morning, Richard.
Hello. Hey, I was kind of wondering why they don't, you know, when these marches and protesters come up. In 1998, in Hayden, Idaho, right near Coeur d'Alene, the Aryan Nation wanted to march in Coeur d'Alene on Sherman Avenue. Well, they did, and the police said, don't go down to the protest and all this. So
right.
What happened was Hudson Hamburgers opened up. You could have a free hamburger. You could go bowling for free. You could watch movies for free. And they raised $1,000 per minute for however long the march lasted. So it lasted for 30 minutes approximately. And they made all this money for human rights entities.
Wow.
And nobody really, there was no violence. Now, granted, this was probably much smaller of a thing. There was maybe 20, 25 people marching. They put their little kids in the hoods and everything, which is kind of disgusting. But Richard Butler, who was the founder of the Aryan Nation, lived in Hayden. And right after that, they had a problem with a car went by and backfired, and Richard Butler's goons chased the car down and shot at him and everything. So they were arrested. Richard Butler was put on trial, and the civil case was $6.3 million against him. So they took his land, his house, his church, and the Hayden Fire Department used it as practice. If you just don't go, maybe it'll get over a little further, a little faster than without violence and such. So,
And there was also a city in Germany that did something similar, where they used that as an excuse to raise money for causes that the marchers certainly wouldn't be interested in. And those have been pretty widely reported on across social media, if nothing else. So what do you think about Richard's point? Instead of showing up to some of these demonstrations and yelling at the people you don't agree with, go somewhere else and just ignore it.
Well, that's a traditional method for dealing with it. These guys thrive on, at least until now, I have a feeling that the new groups are more serious just about getting influence through policy, etc. But in the past, yeah, they thrive on controversy. People going after them, people getting mad at them, people wanting to fight them is the air that they breathe. And if you, the Anti-Defamation League, long for decades until Skokie, when they changed it, had a policy called quarantine. And that is, you just don't go. You know, if a tree falls in a forest, no one's there, is there noise? That's exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's hard for groups to do that because they feel a moral obligation to confront. I've had, over my years in Madison and teaching here, several times really controversial and even evil speakers would come in, and students would come to me, and we would plan what they would do. And I usually first said, don't go. Let him smother out there without oxygen. The oxygen of your country, of your being there and opposing them. Mm-hmm. And but they've usually wanted to go, so I marked out a plan for, you know, how to protest without violating the rights of the speaker. You know, 'cause they were all from my First Amendment class.
Sure.
So quarantine, I think, in many cases, is really a good policy. If you want to get these people so they just don't grow as much, they're not going to grow as much if no one's there to notice what they're doing. Now, the anti-fascist people now who are playing according to a new book coming out by a young scholar at Dartmouth about the anti-fascist playbook, they're similar to the survivors in Skokie because they say, well, it starts small, then it gets big. We know from history we got to confront these guys. But yesterday on the Meet the Press, one of the directors of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who's very critical of these hate groups, and in my view, actually has expanded the definition of hate group to other groups that I don't think fit that category. But he was very good, and he just said, well, the more you fight these guys this way, the more you're undermining the rule of law, okay, you're bringing more violence into the public sphere, and you're giving these guys, making these guys look like martyrs. They're holding a demonstration, you're fighting against them, then their rights are being violated. And he thinks it's a good idea to do something more like the quarantine thing and to let these guys speak, let the bad guys speak for certain reasons. One is so we know they're there, we know what the problem is, and then we can confront it. And also, if you take away the rights of these speakers, they're going to go underground, and then we're going to get less public information about them so we can keep an eye on them and keep them in tow. So a lot of interesting questions here as to, you know, how you should confront, and mm-hmm. If you do, how. If you don't, you know, just do you quarantine them, things like that. So, yeah, it's a really good point. Sorry, long answer, but it's a complicated question.
Hey, well, you know, all these questions are complicated. We could spend hours on this. Richard, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Rio next. Justin is with us. Justin, good morning.
I really enjoyed what you guys just said about that, where you want to watch the bad guys and actually have to hear them out. So when I originally first heard you guys, I was thinking where it would cross the line is, you know, when you start losing education, your passion, and it starts becoming more antagonizing, and the fear factor, intimidation, so on and so forth, is kind of where I feel like it crosses the line, more pointing the finger. But like what you guys just talked about there, it wouldn't hurt to keep your eye on them and kind of know what they're up to, but are they really going to share all of their inside information? I don't want to sidestep this conversation, but it's really burning with me right now is the whole deal with taking down the Confederate statues and not, like, embracing our failures or our history. I heard a report the other day that other countries have had these kind of situations, and rather than take the statues down, they'd put another statue next to it, like turning over another chapter or something, rather than take them down.
Okay, we're just about at news time, Justin, and I'd like the professor to have a chance to respond. Very quickly, we're about a minute away from news. What do you have to say to what Justin just said?
Well, I think he's right. I mean, some of these statues are problematic, given the timing when they were put up, this sort of defiance during the Civil Rights Movement to perpetuate Jim Crow. So I understand that argument. But it is part of our history. And maybe if you want to make it part of our living history, then you do. You add another statue, sort of like a counter-speech statue that is more up-to-date. And so rather than wiping out the visibility of our past, you leave it there for us to see, but then you add to it.
Okay.
To add to the history. You know,
well,
we're a country of bad historical memory. I don't want to see. It's sort of like book.
Yeah. All right. Well, Professor, we'll hold that comment. We'll come back to it in just a moment. We're going to take a break and catch the news. Donald Downs is my guest. We're talking about free speech this morning on the Joy Cardine Show. John Munson in for Joy Cardine today on the Ideas Network of WPR. We're talking about First Amendment issues during the days of lots of protests. Of course, we had the unfortunate events at Charlottesville, but this past weekend, much more peaceful protests held, some protests that didn't take place at all. What are the First Amendment implications here? How do we regulate speech and not regulate it at the same time? It's a fine line We're discussing some of that this morning with Donald Downs, Alexander Michael John, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and a frequent guest on Wisconsin Public Radio when we have these tricky legal issues to talk about. Don't you just love this phone call that you get? Hey, can you come on?
Especially when it's 6 in the morning.
Yeah, well, 6 in the morning. And, well, you know, think how I feel. So, but I appreciate you being here. And we have a lot of callers, and we could spend all day on some of these issues. At Truth in Advertising, I used to teach a mass communication law class UW Superior. So this is the First Amendment was basically the first half of the course. Let's go to the phones. Rich is with us in Rhinelander. Let's take Rich's call next. Rich, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I would really hate to see speech rooms signed down. I know that Professor Downs, no pun on his name, in recent comments said the bad guys and those who are speaking evil. Well, I think it's very easy to begin to define someone who disagrees with me or says absolutely awful, abhorrent things as bad or evil. And I think it's the position of the people in authority who are supposed to keep order, that even if a crowd is yelling, and I disapprove of this, pigs at the police or at a modifier, racist pigs, that it's the right of the people to speak. Because people speak does not allow me to become violent. I object to what I would refer to as neo-Nazis did in Charlottesville. But I also object to the idea that somehow or another that mere speech is a threat to society. The FBI has defined in the past the Religious Society of Quakers, of Friends, the Quakers, as a highly subversive group. I think we have to be very careful when we begin talking about our fellow citizens as speaking badly or being evil.
Professor?
Yeah, it's a fair point, especially when it comes to freedom of speech. My comment when I said evil was thinking of one of the speakers I saw on television vilifying Jews, kind of, you know, demonizing Jews. And I think that's, you know, I guess as a commentator, maybe I should have used more neutral terms, but that's the kind of language I was thinking of. But the caller's right that that's why the First Amendment allows people to say things like that. And it's only when language becomes a threat to somebody else or direct incitement to illegal action or violence. So you're an angry mob, and then you get up in front of the angry mob, and it's sort of losing its head. And you say, go charge that person. And the mob does. That's a direct incitement. So it's really when speech becomes part and parcel or closely connected to an illegal act or violence against somebody or a threat to somebody that it crosses the line. Just spouting a racist diatribe in general is protected speech. But I think some of that content is bad content. But that's my own personal judgment.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate the call. One of the issues I wanted to get into before we completely run out of time, which we always do,
right,
is some of the things that have come up. For example, the Daily Stormer, which is the alt-right, it's their website. They are only findable on the dark web if you're willing to go there, because the companies that provide space for websites have said, we don't want you. Is there a free speech argument to be made about access to having a website on the Internet?
Yeah, there is a kind of a general free speech argument, but it's not a First Amendment argument because the sites are owned by private companies, and the First Amendment only applies to the government, what the government can do or make you do, not have you do, whatever. But I, in listening to just some news on this, there are a lot of people, especially more conservatives, because they're the ones going to be affected by this more, who think that free speech principles are being violated here. These major, like Google, and these major internet companies, search companies, et cetera, are kind of playing censorship, Facebook. And then they look at the membership that is largely liberal, and they think that there might be some sort of bias going on there. Now, that could, in the end, affect the law if the government sees that there's kind of viewpoint discrimination going on. The government then might pass laws requiring these, making these companies more like public carriers, where they have to be more viewpoint neutral and allow all points of views to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be directly a First Amendment issue, but it could become a legal issue if the government ends up taking the side of those who think that they're being excluded.
Mm-hmm.
That's right up in debate. I think John Samples, who's the vice president of the Cato Institute in Washington, just wrote an op-ed about this kind of issue.
Let's take another call. This time it'll be Gary in Merrill next. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. I think a principle that's violated is honest reporting. If you took the black and white words away, mm-hmm. you wouldn't be able to tell which group you're talking about when you talk about fascism or bad behavior or violent behavior. You couldn't separate the group. And the other thing is, when you have one, during the president's campaign, when you had one group that was throwing bricks and beating people walking into the campaign, hardly no reporting was done at all when interstate highways were closed down. It gets almost no mention at all, only the other side. So it's unfair reporting and it's biased reporting. And, it's fascism on both sides. Wait till school starts and the little children start burning their school books. So who's going to be the...
Okay, Gary, we get it. Thanks for the call. Professor?
Yeah, Trump got in trouble for saying that there was a problem on both sides. And there was a way that he wasn't clear enough about denouncing the harms of Nazis. I mean, Nazis have a special... historical significance in America. We fought World War II against them. They did the Holocaust, etc. Okay, so I think Trump arguably properly got in trouble for the way he handled that. But that doesn't mean that some of these other counter protesters were not causing problems too, and did not go there to cause it. He may have been right about that, and the caller alludes to that. I know cases up. I'm getting contact up in Minnesota where counter protesters on the left have shut down. Highways, people can't drive on them. I know that at Middlebury College, when Charles Murray was attacked, and the Professor Sanger who brought him in, you had anti-fascist protesters involved in that, apparently. And just the anti-fascist playbook, they want to themselves to take care of these people rather than the police. That is a recipe for violence.
Well, and then you have this whole kind of internet vigilanteism where there was a campaign on Twitter to out the people who were marching in Charlottesville, and some people have lost their jobs. People have been misidentified and have received all sorts of threats. How far can we go with that?
I think that's I don't know how we can go really far in terms of doing bad things with it, I think. and then the question of the question, what can the law do there? But being outed on the internet and bullied on the internet is a significant phenomenon. And now we're getting left-wing professors on campus who, some of them in the past, been responsible for shouting down speakers at their schools for intolerance from the left, have now been saying things about Trump, and they're getting attacked by internet trolls and threatened and sexual things said about them. I know a lot of students now that are not speaking out with intellectual honesty in class because they're afraid of getting outed on social media for being, usually it's more for being conservative or for not being thoughtful enough or not being sensitive enough. The internet is responsible for a lot of speech, but it's also responsible for chilling a lot of speech. So I think it's a real problem. We've got to try to figure out how to use the internet in a pointed yet civil way. And we're not doing it.
In the wake of the violent clashes in Charlottesville, the Illinois State Senate wants white nationalist and neo-Nazi groups classified as domestic terrorist organizations. What do you think of that, Professor?
Yeah. I think you have to find that what their doctrine is, what is their platform. if they do have a platform for engaging in violence against people, they move in that direction. It's been a few years since I've looked at the federal terrorism statute. I used to, you know, write about it and work with it a bit back in the day when I was more involved in the terrorism issues after 9/11. it's a particular act like the one in Charlottesville could push in that direction. Now, that partly depend upon who is this guy. Was he part of the group that was organized to march? Was he just sort of a lone actor? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I think it's something that is not out of the ballpark to think about, but you want to be careful because, you know, if these groups are, if you broaden that definition too much, you will bring in people that are, you know, just sort of part of the Trump movement. And then you're starting to really crack down on one side of the political divide. So you've got to be careful how you do it. I don't think it's out of the cards, but you've got to be careful.
Professor, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Joy Cardine Show. Really appreciate our conversation. We could do this all day, but we have to run.
Right. Well, next time.
Okay.
There will be next time. So
yeah, this issue's not going away, I'm afraid. Right. Okay. Donald Downs is Alexander Michael John Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Law, and Journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The Joy Cardine Show is produced by Naisha Ellison and Keely Bultina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.